studios of KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is Uprising and I'm Sonali Kohatkar. It's Tuesday, September 15th, 2015. Australia's new Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull represents a possible change from Tony Abbott's regime. We'll speak with Binoy Campmark. Plus, author Eileen Pollock joins us to discuss her new book, The Only Woman in the Room, Why Science is Still a Boys' Club. And Pasco, Washington decides not to charge three officers in the videotaped shooting death of a Mexican immigrant named Antonio Zambrano Montes. We'll speak with Gabriel Portugal of the Latino Civic Alliance. That's coming up after the news. Joining us now to analyze today's headlines is Robert Jensen. He's an author and a professor of journalism at the University of Texas at Austin. Hi, Bob.
Hello, Sonali.
The war in Syria is ramping up even as the refugee crisis in Europe continues to build up. An anonymous U.S. source told AFP that Russian tanks and artillery had arrived in Latakia, a Syrian airbase, bolstering the arsenal of President Bashar al-Assad. A Pentagon official named Jeff Davis also confirmed the presence of Russian troops in Latakia, although Russia maintains that they are simply military advisors and are not participating in the fighting. According to The Guardian, Davis said Washington would welcome Moscow's contributions to the effort against ISIS, but that military assistance for Assad could, quote, risk adding greater instability to an already unstable situation. Millions of Syrians have been displaced by Assad's war and also ISIS attacks. Hundreds of thousands of them are making their way in a steady stream to Europe for asylum, but Hungary has now decided to close its border with Serbia, forcing refugees to remain stuck as they work their way north. Those who forced their way through the border have been detained. Serbia's government has appealed to the EU for help. Well, Bob, this war is becoming increasingly complex. Are you surprised that it now appears as though Syria's government, Russia, and the U.S. are all fighting ISIS and all sides are contributing to the refugee crisis?
Well, sure, there is a responsibility for the crisis and for dealing with the crisis on all sides. But let's remember in the United States that we are the primary motive force behind this crisis. When the United States decided to invade Iraq and destabilize that region, when ISIS formed and moved into Syria, all of this is a direct result of U.S. policy. And that means whatever the Russians are doing that we don't like, and there's lots of reasons not to like what the Russians do, the primary responsibility is ours, and that means the resettlement question is primarily our responsibility as well. Remember, the United States is the most affluent country in the history of the world. It's the third largest country in the world, which means we have the resources more than any other nation to deal with this, and our response to date has been pathetic, and we've been playing Europe is the bad guy, in a sense, and it's mostly our responsibility.
Here in the United States, Bernie Sanders addressed an evangelical Christian school on Monday. Speaking at Liberty University in Virginia to a packed auditorium of 12,000, Sanders, who was on unfamiliar ground, quoted scripture. He said, "Do to others what you would have them do to you." Mr. Sanders is Jewish. He focused the majority of his speech on income inequality, which is his main platform, but added, quote, "I understand that issues of abortion and gay marriage are issues that you feel very strongly about. We disagree on those issues. I get that. But let me respectfully suggest that there are other issues out there that are of enormous consequence to our country and, in fact, to the entire world that maybe, just maybe, we do not disagree on." Other Democratic candidates have not reached out to evangelicals as Sanders has. Bob, what do you make of his speech? Was this a smart move?
Well, I think it was a smart move politically because Bernie Sanders continues to do things that make it clear that he's not a traditional politician. And for a lot of people, that's a draw. I think... while it's easy to say we all care about people and let's all, you know, rally for justice, obviously the question is much more basic. And at Liberty, it was clear that Sanders wasn't talking about the two main areas where he disagrees with those, not people, not only on religion, but on capitalism and on feminism. So the abortion issue, to me, makes no sense if you don't have a feminist analysis. And there was Bernie Sanders trying to kind of, I think, fudge that. He's trying to talk about economic inequality without talking about the problem of capitalism. And I think that's why the audience at Liberty, while they were respectful, weren't moved, because the debate never got past a kind of superficial level.
And finally, a 198-page report by the Ferguson Commission has outlined the major problems that exist in the low-income Missouri area neighborhood, but also suggested solutions. The report, released on Monday, echoed much of what the Department of Justice cited in its report earlier this year, including changing the way local courts fine poor residents for minor offenses. It also found through a survey that a shocking 55% of residents said they're traumatized by experiences of racism. Overall, the report suggests that more than a year after the killing of 18-year-old Michael Brown that sparked a rebellion, little has changed. The commission recommended that Ferguson treat nonviolent offenses as civil rather than criminal cases, including ending the jailing of nonviolent offenders. Addressing the crucial issue of economic justice, the panel also suggested raising the paltry minimum wage from $7.65 an hour to $15 an hour. Well, Bob, these recommendations sound great. The question is, will they be applied?
Well, probably not today, but I think there is a growing movement that is not only in the streets protesting police violence, but leading to political pressure for these kind of changes. You know, I'm going to say, as someone who's white and now comfortably in the middle class with my professor's salary, this was a really important report for also reminding me about what it means to be poor in this country, what it means to be the target. And I think, you know, whatever political outcome there is to this report and other reports like it, those of us in positions of privilege should remember that the world is really set up to make our lives easier. And it's people below us, often not visible to us, given the way the world is organized. And so there's both a political and I think a very personal value in these kinds of reports. And we should be paying attention.
Bob Jensen, always a pleasure to have you on. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll talk to you again next week.
Thanks, Sonali.
Robert Jensen is an author and a professor of journalism at the University of Texas at Austin. This is Uprising. We'll be back after this break. Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. The Australian government saw a major change on Monday with the defeat of the Liberal Party's Tony Abbott. Prime Minister Abbott had provoked global ire over his conservative positions on climate change in particular, but also social issues like same-sex marriage and the treatment of refugees. He will now be replaced by Communications Minister Malcolm Turnbull, whom the New York Times described as, quote, a moderate liberal and a former investment banker and lawyer. At a press conference, Turnbull said that Abbott, quote, has not been capable of providing the economic leadership our nation needs. He has not been capable of providing the economic confidence that business needs. Turnbull will be Australia's fifth prime minister in 5 years. And according to the BBC, many in his party dislike his support for climate change action and gay marriage. Despite its name, the Liberal Party is Australia's Conservative Party. My guest is Binoy Campmark. He is a senior lecturer in the School of Global, Urban and Social Studies within the Bachelor of Social Science program at RMIT University in Melbourne, Australia. He also writes for counterpunch.org. Welcome to Uprising, Binoy.
It's lovely being with you.
Thanks for joining us. Well, remind us how seriously embarrassing Prime Minister Tony Abbott has been. He seems like he was Australia's George W. Bush.
Yes, I suppose to a large extent, the statement is not untrue. What he was, and I think similar to Bush in many ways, this is Bush Jr., of course, he was very much a believer in his particular positions. He took a very strong stance on, for example, market economics on the one hand. He took a very strong stance against refugee and certainly boat arrivals. He famously came up with that slogan, turn back the... And of course, he was one of the first people who came up to support U.S. actions regarding confrontations in Iraq and then very recently Syria regarding an expanded effort in terms of combating Islamic State and ISIL forces. So there's no question about it. He was always very much the pugilist, very much the boxer, which is what he actually trained as when he was at the University of Sydney as an undergraduate student.
Now, who is Malcolm Turnbull? Some suggest he's a moderate, others say that's not true. Some have said he's an ALP member in disguise, ALP being the Australian Labour Party. But what we do know is that he's a mega millionaire, right?
Yes, he made his name actually fighting some very big corporate battles in the 1980s. And he made his name, and for American listeners who are not familiar with the game of cricket, where he actually really made his name was being the representative for the Australian and now late billionaire Kerry Packer, who was very much a funder of the new format of cricket, which was called World Series. So Mr. Turnbull actually is not exactly the grand progressive that some might think he is. He's very much connected with the entrepreneurial spirit, I suppose, of more traditional individual incentives with the Liberal Party, and that's how I think his particular policies are going to reflect when it comes down to the time when he starts settling in.
And how has he fared as Australia's communications minister? Has his term in the government shed any light on what kind of a prime minister he will be?
Well, I don't think it was particularly glorious. When he was communications minister, Australia was facing, as it continues to face, a particular problem with its broadband structure, its communications network, for example, with the internet. And like many countries, the question is, of course, how best to speed it up, how best to plug it, as it were, into the broader World Wide Web in a more efficient way. And the Australian network on that score was always slower, for example, than some comparably, shall we say, states that did not necessarily have the same infrastructure. So that was never a particularly good sight. That was one thing. But the second thing that he always did as communications minister was always snipe, at the back of Mr. Abbott, trying to show that he, for example, was more progressive on climate change than Mr. Abbott. He was always, pulling up the back line and giving the impression that he was more progressive in that regard.
And so let's talk about climate change. It's a very, very important issue. Abbott had very seriously reversed Australia's, measures, the modest measures on climate-friendly policies. How much does Turnbull seem willing to put Australia back on the right path on the issues of fossil fuel extraction and consumption?
Well, this is a very good question, because the dust has yet to settle, as it were, on this engineered ambush on Mr. Abbott. So the question then becomes whether Mr. Turnbull is going to actually bring out the policies where he has suggested that, for example, significant changes have to be made on the emission targets, and whether changes have to be made to the current regime. You see, the current regime is based essentially on a more pro-coal and certainly against, for example, certain other renewables like wind energy. Mr. Abbott was famously against wind turbines and windmills. So it remains to be seen whether Mr. Turnbull is going to actually reverse that policy and where this particularly fits, for example, in what's called the Green Bank, where funding is provided to actually encourage green policies and investment in the infrastructure of Australia. And early days yet, we'll have to see whether Mr. Turnbull has the gumption to move beyond the restrictions that were put in place by the party overall.
I mentioned the quote earlier that Turnbull accused Abbott of not being capable of providing the economic confidence that business needs. How do you take that to mean?
Well, what Mr. Turnbull was doing was trying to narrow the attack, I suppose, on Mr. Abbott. I mean, what's happening essentially here is an attempt to narrow the particular assault to the basis of economic credentials, precisely because the Liberal Party in Australia, as you pointed out in your introduction, actually the conservative market-based party, the party of the marketplace, so to speak, in business, the point is to try to, when you are going to remove a leader, try to remove the leader on supposedly the point that he is supposedly meant to be strongest. And since the Liberal Party prides itself on market performance, and given the fact that Australia is in a bit of strife at the moment, the crisis in China, for example, the issues there, and also given the fact that there is speculation that the mining boom, the long mining boom coming in Australia is probably going to be tailoring off, there needs to be a particular individual of strength and articulating a particular policy where people feel more comfortable. And that is exactly where Turnbull's coming from. Turnbull's arguing essentially that Abbott did not do that properly, that he was all over the place on economics. It's more complicated than that, of course, as it tends to be in politics, but that's the position he's coming from.
Among the major issues nationally is Australia's refugee problem. We referred to the Syrian refugee crisis earlier, and that's been in the news a lot. But Australia has been tackling its own situation far longer than the problem has cropped up on Europe's shores. And locking up refugees in these horrible conditions offshore on isolated islands for a while now, refugees earlier in the year had taken to very, very serious civil disobedience by sewing their lips shut. And we talked about this the last time we'd had you on our program. Is there a chance that Turnbull could change this? Is this an issue on his radar that he considers important enough?
You raise actually the fundamental point here about whether it's important enough. Mm-hmm. There was certainly no mention of it at all in the address, the post-assassination speech, if you like, and certainly the preliminary challenges that were mounted when it came to the challenge to Mr. Abbott. One thing is for sure, Turnbull is going to be tiptoeing around the issue, at least initially. He needs the support of his party. He also knows, for example, that the opposition Labour Party has made it a commitment to turn back the boats, to essentially stick to this very hardline policy, which, as you know, earlier this month, the New York Times wrote a scathing review about the Australian refugee policy and suggested that this was exactly what Europe, for example, did not need to emulate in terms of processing and settling refugees. The Australian example is taken as exactly the most extreme example in terms of approaching refugees, but there is too much, I suppose, support in the Australian electorate for this particular hardline disposition. The question is, will Turnbull be brave enough, if you like, and it will take a rather brave leader to turn back this particular position, to alter the position. It would be impressive if he did, but I do not see him changing the position on refugees, and certainly the symbolic and practical issue of turning back boats arriving on Australian shores.
Mm. Abbott has also come under fire internationally and certainly, of course, domestically in Australia for his attitude and position on Aboriginal communities had made several embarrassing statements about Aboriginal culture. Any sense of whether Turnbull has a slightly better position on those issues?
Well, there's no question about it. He's certainly far more sensitive to the plight of the Australian Indigenous population than Mr. Abbott does. Mr. Abbott always had a very traditionally jaundiced view, if you like, about the Aboriginal population. Essentially, he had a very traditional view about their work ethic, or supposedly lack of. He always had a particular perspective about culture in terms of his own background and the way that policy. It was always very hard line. Mr. Turnbull is a bit more sleek on this particular issue. I actually think that when it comes down to it, he's going to be playing the more softer card. But the reality still remains that, you know, whether spit and polish is going to be used to change the message is one thing. Whether there's a substantive change towards the policy is something that remains to be seen. I also have to add that this is a problem that the Labour Party has to face as well. This is a problem of Australian governance, and it's been like that, of course, for decades.
And I'm glad you brought that up. What sort of opposition from the left exists in Australia that can challenge the Liberal Party? Is the ALP strong enough or progressive enough to challenge Turnbull on these issues? If it turns out that Turnbull extends Abbott-like policies with a, you know, more sensitive tongue?
Well, this is the thing. The opposition has, and this is one of the fascinating things about Australian politics, also very grim, I might add, in terms of witnessing the kind of the central decay of Australian politics in the last 10 years or so. And that is to see the progressive line, if you like, wither on the vine. And essentially what has happened, certainly under Abbott, was that the Labour Party, the supposed progressive party of Australia, started aping and mimicking rather extreme lines of the, you know, of the liberal coalition, so to speak. Now, the result was that the strategists in the Labour Party were hoping that Abbott would end up doing what essentially has happened. Essentially, the Liberals would commit some sort of political suicide, would end up removing Abbott and so on. Now, this has happened, but I don't think that Mr. Shorten, head of the ALP, the Australian Labour Party, will be that thrilled. Because, you see, it's far easier to go to battle in an election with Mr. Abbott, who is, as you pointed out earlier in your program, Australia's George Bush, as it were, George W. Bush. It's far more complicated to go to war with someone like Mr. Turnbull, who is in a rather, as it were, more delicate and nuanced with his messages. And I do think that the Labour Party has a problem, and it's going to have to resort to some other strategy if it wants to defeat Mr. Turnbull at the next election.
Well, Binoy, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Where can our audience read your writings on this issue and others?
Well, I am a regular contributor almost daily and a contributing editor as well to the Counterpunch magazine, also in print edition. So that's www.counterpunch.org. And that has regular pieces that feature some of the discussion points we've been having today.
Thank you so much, as always, for joining us.
Always a pleasure. Anytime. Thank you.
My guest is Binoy Kampmark. He is a senior lecturer at the School of Global, Urban and Social Studies within the Bachelor of Social Science program at RMIT University in Melbourne, Australia. He writes for counterpunch.org. This is Uprising. We'll be back after this break with my guest Eileen Pollack. She is the author of this new book called The Only Woman in the Room, Why Science is Still a Boys' Club. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. Human evolution researchers made a stunning announcement recently. They had discovered a previously unknown species of humans. The remains of Homo naledi, as this new species has been named, was excavated by a team of six scientists. What was remarkable about this team, given the gender homogeneity of science, was that they were all women. Today, women's presence in science is dismal, despite many efforts to recruit and train them in the so-called STEM fields, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. While there was a big jump from the 1970s to the 1990s in women's representation, from the 1990s until now, numbers have stagnated. Statistics are as dismal or worse for people of color. My guest is Eileen Pollack. She is the author of The Only Woman in the Room, Why Science is Still a Boys' Club. She was one of the first two women to have ever earned a Bachelor of Science in Physics from Yale University. Today, she is a writer whose earlier books include Breaking and Entering and Paradise, New York. She is a professor of creative writing at the University of Michigan. Welcome to Uprising, Eileen.
Very pleased to be here, Sonali.
Now, when I started reading your book, I couldn't help but be reminded of my own story. I have 3 degrees in physics and astronomy, undergraduate and master's, and I ended up in broadcast journalism. And so in so many ways, some of the things that you wrote about were intimately familiar to me. Can you tell us what your time at Yale as a physics student, as a female physics student, was like, and why your memories from that time were somewhat traumatic?
Well, you know, one of the problems wasn't so much Yale's fault, but when I was in junior high school, I wasn't allowed to take what passed for advanced courses in science and math. Only the boys were allowed to do that. So I had basically tried to teach myself calculus, and my physics course was not an advanced course. So when I got to Yale, part of the trauma was finding myself in a room with 118 young men, almost all of whom had college, at least one or two college-based physics and calculus courses in high school. So I was just terribly behind right from the beginning. And if you add to that the isolation of being, you know, almost always the only female student in the room, I didn't have any female professors, you know, the isolation combined with always feeling as if I had to catch up. And, you know, it's difficult material. It really just was incredibly stressful. I mean, my professors, I should add, my professors were very nice men. I mean, you shouldn't be picturing, you know, these evil chauvinists who wanted to drive me out. They were young. They were very kind. You know, they didn't treat me badly, but I think they just had no idea really how far behind I was, how isolated I felt, and how much I felt that I didn't fit in just because, you know, there weren't any other girls.
And so the beginning part of your story actually suggests that the cultural bias that starts very early on for girls who are expected to not like science or math or be good at it sets you back if you determinedly and doggedly, like you did, you know, read books on your own, take advanced placement tests and find yourself in college. Those early years and the sort of cultural sexism that still exists today within families and communities can hold girls back.
Right. And, you know, I should say there are three different sort of groups of women and people of color that I'm trying to talk about. And the first group is very difficult to, you know, to describe their experience, because they're the people who were scared away from science and math early. You know, it's sort of like trying to interview the elves who live in your refrigerator and only come out when the door is closed and the light is off, right? You know, finding out why people don't do something is very difficult, because you can't even find them there because they're not doing it. And for those people, I think it's very much cultural forces, you know, a sense that this isn't for me. I don't look like the people who do that thing. We don't share values. And then there are the people like me, and it sounds like you too, who were interested and who wanted to study science and math and just felt that, you know, and I'd be interested in hearing your reasons, but, you know, that at some point the strain of not only how difficult the material can be, but of the isolation, of feeling that you don't belong, that you don't fit the image, that you don't fit in certain ways, gets to be such a strain. And then there are the women who persevere and become scientists and stay in the field for, you know, sometimes quite a while. Maybe they never drop out, or maybe they do. And they might not share some of the same, you know, I hear women who were scientists sometimes say, well, I didn't feel that way, you know, about something that made me drop out. But at that level, there's still a lot of subtle bias where you're, you know, that influences how many resources a woman gets, grants, how she's treated by her students, the sense of respect she feels, salary. And so there are at each stage and for each different type of woman or person of color or someone from a lower socioeconomic group, there are different reasons for, you know, for shying away altogether, for dropping out or switching to another field, or for staying in but maybe not working up to your true potential, or at some point finally saying, you know, I'm going to stay home with the kids. And it seems to be a choice, but, you know, I was really trying to get at why women, so many women who go so far then don't stay in science.
Right.
They switch.
During your time in Yale, you know, once you sort of made it to Yale, you describe in your book many of the feelings of isolation coming from not even sort of sharing those kinds of references, cultural references that the boys and the men in the room would joke about with one another. And that, of course, adds to that feeling of isolation, that you don't belong, that you don't fit in, which can also have an effect long term on women not feeling welcome.
Right. And, you know, there's some studies now that I'm actually writing a piece about, sort of as a follow-up. There's a researcher who found that if you showed a woman a picture of a classroom or an office and said, you know, this is where you would take a course in computer science or where you would work for a computer, you know, a high-tech company, if the decorations were sort of, you know, stereotypical, say a Star Wars poster on the wall, pizza boxes and soda cans and video game cartridges around, you know, a very significant number of the women said, no, I don't want to take that course. I don't want to work there. Hmm. But then if they subtly changed it so that the posters were just nice art posters or nature posters, and, you know, there was a coffee machine and a water cooler and a plant instead of the video games and the pizza boxes, then the percentage of women who said, oh, sure, I would take that course. It sounds interesting. Or I would want to work at that company went shooting up.
Wow.
Whereas it didn't affect it for, you know, it didn't affect it for most of the men. So it's very subtle factors about fitting in, about images of how you see yourself versus how you see the people who seem to already be in the field. And those images, I should say, tend to come from media. They come from movies. They come from TV shows like The Big Bang Theory. So, you know, sometimes they're not even realistic. You know, The Big Bang Theory has a little bit of truth in it. There are some people who are like Sheldon, you know, in the field, or Raj. But, you know, that's a stereotype. That's just...
And even the women in that show are stereotypical.
Exactly. Who would you want to be? Do you want to be Amy, who in real life... So Mayim Bialik, who plays Amy, in real life has a PhD in neuroscience.
Wow.
And is an attractive, well-dressed woman. And to fit the stereotype, they make her be dumpy and so odd and, you know,
yeah,
deadpan. You know, who would want to be Amy? You want to be Penny, who next door, who's, you know, pretty and has real emotions and is totally math and science illiterate, you know.
Right.
So where are we getting our stereotypes?
Right. So you got your degree, but then you didn't remain in physics. You're now teaching creative writing. You've written several books. Why? What was the reason why you went as far as you did and then and decided to change careers?
Well, you know, I didn't know the answer to that question when I went to write the book. I was responding to Larry Summers, the then president of Harvard, who was wondering where are all the female physicists on his faculty at Harvard. And
maybe they just don't get it, right? Maybe they just don't have the brains wired for science.
Right, exactly. And so I actually sat down to write him an email to tell him. And I had to stop and think because I didn't completely understand myself, because I, in fact, despite the isolation, despite coming from behind, by the time I graduated, I was the top of my class. I had done all this original research in theoretical physics, and I loved this stuff. And I had to think, why didn't I go on? And it was a very subtle reason, and surprising even to me. It was that I had worked so hard, come from so far behind, done so well, and no one ever said, wow, look at what you did. You must be really good at this. No one even asked me what I was going to do. Was I going to go on to graduate school? When I didn't apply, no one seemed to care. No one seemed to get that I was really good at it. And as I think this is true, more true of women than men, we look for someone else to say, you're pretty, you're smart, you should do this, you should do that. But I also felt that they knew, they're professional physicists, and if I were really good, someone would be telling me to go on. Mm-hmm. And I just, I also looked ahead to what I thought that life would be like. And, you know, the rest of my life feeling that isolated and people discouraging me rather than encouraging me, as opposed to I took a few writing classes and within 15 minutes had received more praise and more sort of human contact than in 4 years of me. And I don't actually think I would, you know, I'm not a better writer than I, certainly at that point, than I was a physicist. So it's the encouragement factor,
right.
I think.
Well, Eileen, so much of what you're saying is resonating with me personally. Perhaps it is with the women in our audience who are either in science or were in science. For me, it was statements made by my professors who, despite being top of my class, I was told, well, maybe you're just not cut out for this.
Exactly.
Interesting story. When I was an undergraduate, I went to the Vatican Observatory Summer School program to do a summer program in astronomy where there were students from about 20 different countries, about 25 students, only 7 of whom were women. And we actually got to meet the Pope, John Paul II. And as I walked away, I got to shake his hand. I was the first woman who shook his hand. As I walked away, he turned to the man next to him, the Jesuit next to him, and said, "Are they all scientists?"
Oh, my. Yes, so you know what I'm speaking
of. Oh, absolutely. And of course, you know, to a small extent, we get this in journalism as well. But today we have Neil deGrasse Tyson. We have, you know, these 6 women who were part of this incredible discovery. And I think this is an interesting story. The story I raised at the beginning about the female scientists involved in the discovery of Homo naledi, this new species of humans. It's interesting that the scientist who started the project, he's a man named Lee Berger, realized that not just anybody could fit into the small openings of the cave.
Small people.
He recruited slender and younger female scientists to do the work, primarily because they could physically fit into the space. And this story to me illustrates that if the men in charge really wanted women's participation, they could actively make it happen just
by trying
hard.
Isn't that amazing that when it's seen as a priority? And we should add too that so a lot of male scientists seem to think that this is what I hear, that we're talking about lowering standards by bringing in women or people of color. And I say to them, and this was told to me by Meg Gurry, who was the head of the physics department at Yale. She's an astrophysicist, and it's so brilliant. She said, if you need all your if you need a certain amount of scientists in your society, and you only have one barrel from which to draw them, the white male barrel, you have to go pretty far to the bottom of the barrel to get the number of scientists you want, and there's some pretty mediocre people in there. But if you have all these other barrels, women, people of color, people who, you know, went to not so good high schools, they're very bright people in those barrels, and you would have the top of each barrel, right? So you're raising the quality of not even to talk about that when you have more diverse viewpoints, or in this case, thinner people who can get, you know, thinner, very brave people, I should add,
yeah,
who can get into those caverns and know what they're finding with the bones and how to get them out. It's the science benefits. It's not, you know, it's the opposite of lowering standards. In a way, it's raising them,
yeah,
to allow the smart people, the talented people, the creative people of lots of different barrels
so
to get to the field.
What is the takeaway then? Because I know that there are plenty of sincere, well-meaning scientists, science departments around the country that realize what you're saying is true and want to work to make science more attractive, a more hospitable place for women, for girls, for people of color, for lower-income people. We hear a lot about universities attempting to recruit lower-income students of color, but you know, our affirmative action policies have been laid waste to legally. But as your book points out, it's more than just legal issues; it's cultural issues. What sort of advice would you give to a department looking to improve the diversity of the department?
Right, and I mean, I do think it needs to start much earlier. So we need to be looking at the images that we're sending out, and the fact that we're, you know, girls and people of color tend not to be encouraged to take certain courses in 7th grade or, you know, high school. But once we get to, you know, the college level, to businesses, there are a lot of things. And a lot of it comes from what I was saying before, convincing people that what you're talking about is actually not lowering standards, not, you know, that this is going to be good for science. But also, it's so much of this is subtle bias that people aren't even aware of, that women are as biased against other women, people of color, are as biased against other people of color, seeing them as scientists, as is true of white men.
Hmm.
And so if you show people the studies that have been done recently where social scientists have documented gender bias and racial bias, bias against different ethnicities among scientists of all genders, of, you know, all races, that you may think you're not holding these biases and acting on them, but look at this graph and look at how, you know, when we sent you a resume, a job application, and we said it was John applying, you wanted to give him the job and mentor him and pay him a certain amount of money. But when we changed the name and it was Jennifer, you suddenly didn't think she was hireable or mentorable, or you wanted to give her a lower salary, whether you were male or female, however old you were. The scientists respond to that, right? That's data. And they go, oh, no. Oh, my gosh. How do I prevent myself from being biased? They're scientists. They don't want to be biased, right? It's unscientific. So once you do that, then there are programs you can put into place to nurture people, to, I mean, so it's convincing. And the other thing I would say is scientists tell me over and over that they don't encourage anyone, because you have to be so tough and dedicated to go on in a career in science. So getting away from that mindset, because in fact,
it's like a culture of hazing, honestly.
Exactly.
Because I went through it, you should too.
Right. And it's a culture of weeding out the unfit at the earliest possible moment without understanding that that's too early and you don't know what you're doing at that point. That nurturing and encouraging, at least for a while, right, I would say, into graduate school, rather than weeding everybody out freshman year who wasn't blessed with like an amazing background in high school, that's stuff that can definitely be changed and is starting to be at certain schools. So Carnegie Mellon, Harvey Mudd, there are certain schools that pride themselves on, you know, Olin College of Engineering, and those might actually be a model for other programs.
Well, Eileen, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. We'll post a link to information about your book from our website, uprisingwithsonali.com. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. I feel like as if I've met a sister in arms.
Same here. Eileen, take care. Eileen Pollack is my guest. She is the author of The Only Woman in the Room, Why Science is Still a Boys Club. She was one of the first two women to have ever earned a Bachelor of Science in Physics from Yale University. And she is now a professor of creative writing at the University of Michigan. By the way, last year I gave a TEDx talk that is titled My Journey from Astrophysics to Radio Journalism, or How I Found Meaning in My Life. If you're interested in my story, you can find that online. We'll be back after this break. Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. Recently, a controversial police shooting of an unarmed Mexican man in the small town of Pasco, Washington, made national news when the officers involved were not charged. The man in question was a 35-year-old Mexican national, Antonio Zambranos Montes, who was confronted on February 10th of this year by three officers for throwing rocks at cars. A bystander's cell video of the shooting, which has been viewed well over a million times, shows police chasing the unarmed man with his hands up in the air before he was shot 17 times. The Franklin County prosecutor in Washington last week decided not to charge officers Ryan Flanagan, Adam Wright, and Adrian Alaniz, prompting community protests. My guest is Gabriel Portugal. He is the founding member of the Latino Civic Alliance, a former commissioner with the Washington State Commission on Hispanic Affairs. Welcome to Uprising, Gabriel.
Thank you for having me.
How do you explain why the prosecutor decided not to charge the officers involved?
I believe it's a selection of facts that the prosecutor decided to consider. Facts that I guess would illustrate that the officers were following policy procedures and doing their job. The prosecutor did not include facts that Antonio Zamora did not pose a life threat against the officers as he was running away. And for example, the time the Franklin prosecutor said that they did not have time to take alternative options, like going to the car to get a beanbag, shotgun, or
and actually, Gabriel, we're having some trouble with your phone line. We're going to call you right back, okay? So just hang up your phone and we'll call you right back. My guest is Gabriel Portugal. He is the founding member of the Latino Civic Alliance and former commissioner with Washington State Commission on Hispanic Affairs. And he is in Pasco, Washington, working on very important issues of why the Mexican nationals police shooting was ignored essentially by the prosecutor. And we're going to try to get him on the line, but actually we'll take a short break before we do that. Do bear with us. And we have Gabriel Portugal back on the line with us. Can you continue the reasons that you were explaining why the prosecutor decided not to charge the officers involved?
Yes, but I was trying to inform you that our view of the decision was the selection of facts that the prosecutor decided to focus on. They are saying that there were no time to take alternative options, and we're saying there was plenty of time. More than 5 minutes was the chase after they were chasing Antonio, and 5 and so many minutes and seconds, they would have time. But three officers chasing Antonio, and to say that they didn't have time to go back to the car and get an alternative option like a beanbag rifle or something, to us makes no sense. That time is not a is not, and so. So the selection of the facts are what we think that that's how he made the decision.
And people are certainly welcome to watch the video online. Just know that, of course, as any video of a police officer shooting can be traumatizing, this one certainly is. But I made myself watch it. And what was really interesting was that in the video of Montes' death, he is seen with his hands down in front of him when he was shot by all three cops. All he had in his hand was one, maybe two rocks. And he was shot by all three cops who were just a few feet away from him. But the Franklin County prosecutor, Sean Sant, said the cops were justified in shooting him because they were worried about being killed by the rocks from his hand. First of all, he had only two hands and there were three cops. All three fired their weapons. Were all three worried about being killed by a two-handed man with one or two rocks? You know, he didn't have three hands. Secondly, if the video shows him with his hands by his side when he was shot, how were they being threatened?
Yes, we have one of the relatives of Antonio, our aunt, told me this Saturday we had a rally after the decision, And she said that 7 months ago, Antonio had an accident at a falling off from a ladder and broke his wrists, and he had metal plates on his wrists. It's not on the report, and nobody's saying anything. We're thinking that the coroner inquest will bring light into that. Is it true what they're saying? That did he have those metal plates because he had hurt his wrists when he fell off the ladder when he was picking fruit? If that comes out on the inquest, the coroner inquest, then, you know, that will also tell us that he didn't have the strength to throw rocks, you know, on a life-threatening, you know, matter. So that's another thing that we're waiting.
The Guardian reported that one of the officers, Ryan Flanagan, was asked why three officers chased a man armed with only a rock and shot him. Flanagan's response, well, one rock can kill you. How do you respond to that?
It's one of those things that we we were also complaining about. Some members of the police families and in fact, one officer, I don't want to say his name, but I went to the city manager and complained because he was posting a picture of a person hit by a rock on Facebook. And he said, this is what a rock can do. And so the same thing that this, the Flanagan, is they want to make sure that we are all shocked by what a rock can do. So I went to the city manager. I said, you know, we don't want people doing that from the department. They told him to take that off, and he did immediately. But what I said to the manager, we don't want people posting what bullets can do to a person, you know.
There you go. And if the police officers were afraid for their lives with a rock-wielding man, they could have simply run away. But it was them who chased him with guns drawn and then shot him, all three, at the same time when he was just a few feet away from them. And it's pretty incredible that it was all captured on video for all to see. Also, I understand The Guardian reported that none of the officers who were involved with the incident were interviewed until nearly 3 months after the initial shooting. Why?
That's a thing that we don't know, because it could be 3 months, 3 weeks, but we know it was close to a month that they didn't get an interview, but we don't have exact information, because, as you know, the officers have
Fraternal Order of Police.
Yeah, it's like a union. Mm-hmm. And it protects them. They have some language there that is there for this kind of incidents where they have that latitude to do some things that, you know, they're not appropriate, but the city negotiates those contracts with the police union, and we have no access to that because it's between the union and the city.
Right. Now, can you explain the demographics of Pasco, Washington, to our audience, and why this story and this incident has hit so hard in the community? And also, how has the family of Antonio Zambrano Montes responded?
Well, you know, as you can imagine, it's been really difficult for the family as they lost, Antonio. And so we have a lot of, they want to criticize the way Antonio lived his life and that he was involved in inappropriate behavior or whatever. but the family is just... it has their own lawsuit. They're conducting their own, legal. I can't really comment on that.
Sure.
But they have their own lawsuit going on and focusing on the civil rights, where the civil rights of Antonio violated, and you know that would be for the court and the lawyers to decide. But I think they were.
What about the FBI investigation of this incident? There was supposed to be an FBI investigation happening. What came of that?
We met with the FBI, I believe it was maybe March or so, where they came, Michael Ormsby came over and talked to us and said that they were monitoring that, but like the same case with the governor, they felt that they wanted to let the process go through, and then they would take action. But they were monitoring with the what was going on, and so by the time the decision is made, I think they're going to have ample information to go ahead, and then hopefully they will do the independent investigation like the Attorney General is doing. We also have a letter that we sent to the Latino Civic Alliance, and a letter to the governor asking for an independent investigation and for the prosecutors to step aside. But the same response, where they wanted to let that process go, and now that is done, I think the governor has ordered, in a way, the Attorney General to take over an independent investigation. Hmm.
Finally, Gabriel, do you feel that the deaths of Latinos and Latin American immigrants at the hands of police doesn't get enough media coverage? And do you see common cause with the Black Lives Matter movement? Of course, Black men are still overwhelmingly far more likely to be targeted and killed by police violence than any other demographic as a fraction of the population. But it seems as though there are a lot of shootings of Latinos, such as Manuel Diaz in Anaheim here in Southern California, that just don't get enough attention?
I think that some of it is true, yes. Somehow here when, well, from the very beginning, when I met or spoke to the media, they asked if this was a racially motivated killing. And we kept saying that we don't have all the facts to say if it is racially motivated or if it's not. So it appears that to me, some media outlets are kind of were disappointed. They wanted to have a clear answer, like, yes, it's racially. And sometimes I think the media wants to make it more sensationalist and make a little bit of exaggerations. I'm not sure, but I feel that's one of the things why we were not covered, because they dropped us as soon as we said we don't know, you know, because we don't have all the info. Then the media did not cover Antonio's death.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, Gabriel. Very quickly, give out the website for Latino Civic Alliance.
Excuse me?
Can you give out the website for Latino Civic Alliance?
Yes, you can visit the Latino Civic Alliance. Would you like what?
We'll post a link. We'll post a link to the website when we find it from our site. Thank you so much. Gabriel Portugal is the founding member of the Latino Civic Alliance. This is Uprising. Anna Bus is our assistant producer and technical director. And Teddy Robinson is our audio engineer. Our website is uprisingwithsonali.com, where you can find all of the links to organizations of the guests that we have on the air. Our theme music is by Quetzal. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, host and executive producer of Uprising. I'll see you next time.